Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Lord, here we go again. I've had this case requested several times over the last few months, and I've had to wait on it because I've done several cases like these recently, and I want to kind of spread them out. But the day is finally here. Back at it again with those kooky offshoot Mormons, and you know I'm bringing you a take on this that you haven't heard before. I've seen this case covered on other channels, and they've all done a good job, but none have really touched too deeply on an element of this case that's really important. You know I'm all about the discussion of what makes people do what they do. The men who did what they did in our story today were motivated because they got involved with a program that I have had some personal experience with. It's called Harmony Impact Training, and it was once a Utah phenomenon. It's now died down, but it still exists. Mormons are mad about multi-level marketing, and they are mad about self-improvement courses. The number of people I know that have left the Mormon church just to turn around and start worshiping Tony Robbins or Teal Swan or Donald Trump, other personalities, it's a lot of people. The face of who they're worshiping changes, but they're still worshiping somebody. Because Mormons are already so programmed to be susceptible to things like multi-level marketing and self-improvement courses, this particular brand of, I'm just going to say what it is, nuttiness, really took off with the Mormons. And this impact training did a number on a couple of guys that were... They were right up there on the crazy ladder with Ron and Dan Lafferty and Ervil and Joel LeBaron fighting for that top rung on the ding-dong ladder. Why are they always brothers? So I'll try to keep my snarkiness to a minimum. No, I won't. No, I won't. You know me. No, I won't. I can't. Today we are talking about Taylor and Justin Helzer and the cult they formed called the Children of Thunder. Let's get into it. 1997. I'm going to start this story off a little differently from the versions you may have heard before. About 10 years after starting my dance school, my music career was taking off, and I simply did not have time to do both things. Teach dance, run the school, put on the recitals, costume hundreds of dancers, and travel around the country performing as a singer. I decided that I was going to put my dance school up for sale. I'm not going to go into too much detail here, but I'll just say this. I sold my school to some people. I only met them once, and there ended up being some issues there. After they took over, I started getting calls from the parents of my students, who were now their students. And these parents were upset. Their children were coming home from dance class talking about this thing called impact. And that's, again, part of what we're going to be talking about today. I was not aware that the people who had purchased my dance school were involved in this Harmony Impact training program. Apparently, they were trying to get some of their students, who were my students that they inherited, to get involved with impact. And the students' parents were not happy about it. So for months, I had to field calls from people I had great relationships with, people who trusted their children to me for 10 years, asking me what in the hell I had gotten them into, and it was extremely unpleasant for me. So back then, I was kind of forced to look into what impact training is. As with a lot of sinister things, it looks fine from the surface, but it is not fine. To prepare for this episode, I went through a whole bunch of Reddit threads and threads of complaints to Glassdoor and the Better Business Bureau. And yeah, impact, it still exists. Like I said, there are some people who are very, very against it. You won't see any of this part of it in the literature, but I have spoken with people who went through the program. It's one of those things where, according to what I was told, they tear you down to an infant. They regress you back to an infantile state, and then they build you back up again. They reshape you so that you come out better, stronger, more confident. Oh, and by the way, this happens over a weekend. Stupid me. I've been meditating and reading up on philosophy. I could just pay $1,200 and go to a weekend seminar and I'm fixed. I cannot. If you go to Harmony Impact Training's website, it looks like all the other self-help seminars. But in talking to people who have been through it, it's not like a lot of other programs. The program also claims that special people, superior people, are drawn to the program through some force because they're aware that they're special. And Impact will help them uncover just how special they are for $1,195 a weekend. If you live in Utah, this is probably a lot funnier than it is to most of you. All right, let me get myself back together. Hold on. So what does this have to do with today's story? Impact, which some people call a self-help program, others call it a cult, influenced our subject for today greatly. I wanted to touch on this Impact program because I think understanding it a little bit might give you some more insight into the people and into this story that you haven't heard before. I always try and give you guys some new information, or at least a new take on the information that we have, because a lot of us have heard these same stories over and over. Sometimes there isn't any extra info, but if there is, I do try and find it for you. So now let's go back to the beginning and let me introduce you to the people involved in what becomes a very disturbing murder story. This is Glenn Taylor Helzer, who usually went by Taylor. He was born on July 26, 1970 in Lansing, Michigan, to Jerry and Karma Helzer, who were both devout Mormons. But I want to be clear, they were devout Mormons who had some very fringe beliefs. Taylor's mother, Karma, believed that her sons, especially Taylor, were, let's say it all together, you know the drill from the previous episodes about cults, these people are special, you guys. They are always very, very special. Chosen by God, pre-selected, hand-picked to lead the rest of us moronic sheep. Even when Karma was pregnant with Taylor, she believed that she was carrying a divine being, a child who was put on earth to lead and to receive prophecies and to become a mouthpiece for Christ. Hold it together. The family of five would go on survivalist training weekends where they learned to live off the land because, you know, these types are always obsessed with the apocalypse. Who wants to survive an apocalypse? I sure as hell don't. I'll be sitting in a lawn chair, sipping a cocktail and listening to some good music, waiting for the asteroid to hit. I don't want to be stuck in a hellscape worse than what we've got now with a bunch of survivalist lunatics fighting over Twinkies. Just blow me up. Taylor has one sister and he has a brother named Justin. He went to high school in California and then went into the National Guard in Texas. All throughout his teen years, Taylor was obsessed with the Book of Mormon. He read it repeatedly and he memorized a lot of it as well. There are times when Taylor would stay up all night reading the Book of Mormon and would then take it to school with him the next day. Like most young men who are active in the Mormon church, he served a 2-year mission. He was sent to Brazil on his mission, and when his mission was finished, he came home and got married to a woman named Anne in 1993, and they had 2 daughters together. Taylor worked as a stockbroker in Concord, California until fall of 1998. He had been having some pretty serious struggles that people at work noticed. He behaved oddly at times, and there were also incidents where he seemed to lose his temper. He was able to kind of hold it back, but people could tell he was really angry. After being sent to a psychiatrist, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. His wife, Anne, had separated from him in 1996, and Taylor was living on his own. Taylor was always very close to his brother, Justin, and they shared a lot of things in common. And then Taylor discovered Impact Training. After his first session, Taylor was hooked. Impact cuts you off from everyone you know. They put you in a room, and then for hours upon hours, you are shouted at, you are screamed at, you are told that in order to break through the walls that everyone has put around you to be to be who they want you to be, you have to break those walls down. And if you do, you will find You will rebirth the new magnificent you that others are trying to keep you from being. You know, people just don't think about you that much. They don't think about me. They don't think about, people think about themselves. They don't think about other people that much. So when you're in this room, people are shouting terrible things at you and about you with the goal of stripping away all of your sense of self and confidence. And it's done in a very aggressive manner to the point that people end up in the fetal position, like crying and rocking back and forth. It's all very dramatic and corny, and I just find it ridiculous. But as we know, some people are really attracted to this hokey, performative stuff. So when Taylor comes out of Impact, he has decided that he's been missing out on life because Mormonism is too restrictive for him. He decides that he knows more about the Mormon doctrine than anybody else on earth, and he understands it on a deeper level. So what does that mean? You know, he doesn't have to follow the rules. We talk about this all the time. Cult 101, somebody's special. They have information other people don't have. They want to have lots of sex. They want to have lots of alcohol or drugs, whatever it is. And God says that's okay for them because they're higher evolved, more highly evolved than the rest of us are. So Taylor starts drinking, and then he starts having a lot of sex. He starts doing drugs. He gets this girlfriend named Carrie Furman, and she moves into a house with Taylor and Justin. Taylor grows his hair out long and stopped showering apparently as well. And this was not okay with the people at Morgan Stanley. So the company then sent him to get the psychiatric help, and that's when he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Although there are people that believe Taylor was faking those symptoms. Taylor starts to tell people that he is a prophet of God, because of course he does. Taylor tells people that he has been placed on this earth with a special calling from God. He then writes his own version of the Ten Commandments. And he calls them, my hell, stop, the 12 Principles of Magic. The 12 Principles of Magic. Taylor begins devising money-making schemes. He's going to start a pornographic film company. He's going to get into electrolysis, like hair removal. He's going to start something called the Feline Club, where hot young guys like movers and shakers are going to meet up with prostitutes and do ecstasy. And they're all apparently going to pay Taylor for this privilege. So then Taylor takes a bunch of photos of his girlfriend, Carrie, to try to get her into Playboy. Then he starts to try to get her to recruit other women to start like a prostitution ring. And that's when Carrie was out. She left Taylor. Things had become a little too weird for Carrie, but the weirdness hadn't even begun. May 31st, 1999. Taylor and Justin decide to go to a murder mystery dinner that was being put on by the Mormon congregation in Walnut Creek, California. They show up to this party in black trench coats with their slicked back ponytails, and people were a little wary of them. While they were at this party, they met this woman, Dawn Godman. Dawn becomes kind of transfixed. She's obsessed with the Helzer brothers, and they start spending a lot of time together. The brothers tell Dawn that they are prophets of God and that they are the heads of a group called the Children of Thunder. Dawn instantly wants to be part of the group. She moves in with Taylor and Justin, kind of takes Carrie's place in the house. It's a very strange situation, but Taylor loves having this disciple, this minion, this woman waiting on him hand and foot, and he takes full advantage of that. Then Taylor meets this woman, Selena Bishop, in the spring of 2000 at a rave. Selena is instantly smitten with Taylor. Now, Selena is the daughter of the musician Elvin Bishop, who had the hit song in the 70s, Fooled Around and Fell in Love. I actually love that song. Selena and Taylor began spending a lot of time together, but Selena was being deceived. First of all, she's told to call Taylor Jordan. She is told that she is not to tell people about their relationship. She's fooled into believing that Taylor has some kind of supernatural power, and she keeps his secrets. She's loyal, and she's in love with Taylor, but that wasn't enough for him. Taylor wants to know that Selena is all in. He tells her about some very dark plans that he has, and he instantly sees that Selena is not comfortable with them. Taylor Helzer is getting ready to launch his biggest scheme yet. And in order to do that, he is going to need some serious capital, like hundreds of thousands of dollars in capital. When he talks about this plan of his, he is upset to see that Selena is worried and doesn't like the plan. He wants her to be excited about it. He wants her to be on board, and she just isn't. Her refusal to bend the knee to this delusional, self-proclaimed prophet will end up costing her her life. July 30th, 2000. A woman named Nancy Hall becomes concerned about her parents. She cannot get them to pick up their house phone, and this is very unusual. So she drives to their residence, this home here, and she immediately notices that their van, which is always parked in the driveway, is gone. Nancy lets herself into the home and begins to walk around. At first, everything appears to be normal, but then she realizes things are far from normal. As you can see in this police footage, the house is in order, but Nancy notices that there is a bowl in the sink that has mold on it, and Nancy knew her mother would never leave a moldy dish in the sink. Now she's worried that her parents have not been gone just for hours, but perhaps for more than 10 days, because that's the last time she had spoken to them. There is no sign of the couple in the house, and there isn't any sign of violence either. The couple has just vanished from their home. The police are concerned. They know something is wrong here, and they begin looking for this woman's father and mother. Their names were Ivan and Annette Steinman. They also begin looking for the Steinman's van. They send out the description and the license plate number, and soon police find this van sitting on a street abandoned. Days pass, and people begin to fear the worst as the search for the missing couple continues. August 2nd, 2000. A call comes into the Woodacre Police Department. A man tells the dispatcher that he has heard what he believes to be 6 gunshots, and he asks the police come to his neighborhood. He also tells the dispatcher that he heard someone running down the street after the shots were fired. They got into a car and pulled out of the area very quickly. The 911 dispatcher asks if the man can give a description of the car, and he said, unfortunately, no, he had only heard it leave. He had not seen it. The dispatcher sends police to the area, but before they can get there, a second call comes into 911. It's from a neighbor that says there are 2 people shot and dead inside a rental unit that he owns. Detective Steve Nash was sent to the scene. He arrives to find a man dead on the floor next to a bed and a female dead laying in the bed. They have both been shot with a 9mm gun. The couple is quickly identified through their driver's licenses as Jennifer Villarin and her boyfriend James Gamble. The rental unit actually belonged to Jennifer's daughter, and Jennifer had been house-sitting for her daughter. Who is Jennifer's daughter? Selena Bishop, Taylor Helzer's girlfriend. Investigators then try to track down Selena Bishop, but Selena is missing. They can't find her at home or at work, and this immediately sent up red flags. Police go to Selena's workplace, this restaurant here called the Two Bird Cafe, and there they do find some information. Selena's friends had seen her the night before the double murder at a bar with her boyfriend, a man they knew only as Jordan. Her friends tell the police that Selena and her boyfriend were headed towards Yosemite to go camping, so rangers were sent into the park. They look in all the campgrounds, the places Selena was supposed to be, and they do not find Selena or this elusive person called Jordan. Selena's aunt, Olga Land, goes on television begging for the safe return of her niece, but still, no information comes in to help in the investigation. Police officers are sent to Selena's home to search for anything that might help them find her. They locate her diary, and in it, they read a disturbing entry where she talks about her boyfriend Jordan's big plans, and she says she does not want to be anywhere around him when he executes these big plans. This adds to the concern for Selena's safety. A day goes by without much new information, but police do learn that Selena's boyfriend Jordan lives with his brother Justin in Concord, California. Then they get a big break. Someone from the Two Bird Cafe where Selena worked calls the police and tells them that they have found Selena's pager. She must have left it at work. The police go and pick up the pager and begin going through the numbers on it. There are a lot of calls to a number linked to a man named Justin Helzer. Then they find out that yes, Justin lives with his brother, but his brother's name isn't Jordan, it's Taylor. They obtain a photo of Taylor and they take it to Selena's workplace. They show it to her friends and coworkers and they say that yes, that is Selena's boyfriend that they know as Jordan. Now police know Jordan is actually Taylor Helzer. Police run the names Justin Helzer and Taylor Helzer through a records check, and they learn that Justin Helzer had purchased a Beretta 9mm handgun very recently. It's this gun right here. The purchase of the handgun that matched the caliber of shell casings found at the double murder that was now related to a missing person, was enough for police to get a search warrant for the Helzer brothers' house in Concord. Officers from the two police departments in Marin County and Concord begin to wonder, could the double murder in Woodacre, Selena's disappearance, and the missing couple in Concord be related? On August 7th, officers from Marin and Concord counties arrive here at the Helzer residence to execute their search warrant. They surround the home, not sure what to expect. They had some information that indicated the Helzers might be dangerous. The police break down the front door and take Justin Helzer and Don Godman into custody. Taylor runs and tries to escape. He goes out the back window and jumps over this fence onto a walkway, but as his feet hit the ground, Officer Nash points his gun at Taylor and he surrenders. Taylor is taken into custody and booked. As police begin to walk through the Helzer home, they find some disturbing clues. As you can see, the house is a total mess, except for the bathroom, which is spotless. It also smelled strongly of cleaning solution. Then police found some dark spots on the carpet, which was soaked, and the Helzers had set out some industrial fans to try and get the wet carpet to dry. In one room, they find a pile of brand new duffel bags and a safe that they break into. Inside the safe is the 9mm weapon that killed Jennifer and James. In a desk drawer, they find Annette Steinman's driver's license and Morgan Stanley documents showing the Steinman's six-figure account. Now the police know for sure the murders and the disappearances are linked. The Steinman's van that was found on the street earlier had just been dusted for prints. They were matched to Justin Helzer's prints that were all over the van. So now they know they've got the right people in custody, but they're not talking. Where are the Steinmans and where is Selena Bishop? Taylor and Justin Helzer, along with Don Godwin, are arrested and held for the murders of Jennifer Villarin and James Gamble, her boyfriend. Police continue to search for the missing elderly couple and the missing woman, but they're having a difficult time turning up any new leads. Then a call comes into dispatch from a man who had been riding a jet ski on a river near Sacramento. This man has recovered a couple of duffel bags and there are human body parts in them. Police dispatch boats and divers to the area and shut the river down. Over the next several days, as they search, they find a total of 9 duffel bags near the delta of the river. The press gathers as they are hauled out one by one. Detective Nash told the press that he was shocked and horrified at the brutality of this crime. He said he had never seen anything like this, and neither had other officers that were working on the case. Investigators then find out that Dawn Godman had been to the bank several days before her arrest, and she had attempted to deposit 2 checks totaling $100,000. The checks were drawn on Ivan and Annette Steinman's account, and they were made out to Selena Bishop. Police later determined that Selena had in person opened a bank account, but then apparently when she found out what was going to happen, she resisted. She backed out. As the body parts are examined, it is confirmed. They belong to Ivan and Annette Steinman and to Selena Bishop. All 3 people had been murdered and dismembered by the Helzers with Dawn's help. New charges were then brought against the Helzers and against Dawn for murder, kidnapping, and extortion. Justin's attorney immediately went on the defensive, stating that Justin was totally innocent and had nothing to do with the crimes. Taylor's attorney told the press that her client was insane, that he was very mentally ill and very unstable, didn't even know where he was or what was happening to him, let alone the fact that he had murdered 5 people in cold blood. Well, that attorney's claim lost all credibility when Taylor's jailers discovered he was trying to write to Playboy and sell his story for $400,000. Taylor's mother then goes to the press, crying and asking for God to send his, quote, impeccable light of justice to save her son and bring forth the truth. Dawn wasn't saying a word. She wouldn't talk to anyone for the most part, other than to say that Taylor was a prophet of God and that she was a true believer. The prosecution then hired a cult expert, this man named David Sullivan, and they sent him in to talk to Dawn. Sullivan has studied Impact, and let's just say he's not a fan. Dawn first believed that this cult expert was sent by God and that he was there to help her and to free Taylor. Sullivan spent weeks with Dawn, and gradually she began to come back to reality. When she did, she could not believe what she had done, could not believe that she had assisted these monsters in their murder plot. Once she was free of the brainwashing, she told the police that she would do whatever she could to assist in the prosecution of the Helzer brothers, and she did just that. In exchange for Dawn's testimony, the DA agreed not to pursue the death penalty during her trial. As Dawn begins to talk, investigators realize that she has lived through a real-life horror film. Taylor had copies of some wealthy people's accounts from his work at Morgan Stanley. Those are the people he targeted. Oh boy, it makes you wonder who's in charge of your finances, doesn't it? Actually, really scary. Taylor's plan was to kidnap these people and force them to liquidate their accounts. He assumed that Selena was going to help him. Selena was supposed to be in charge of depositing the checks, withdrawing the cash, and then bringing it to Taylor. But Taylor decided that since Selena did not want to be involved, that she knew too much, and Taylor didn't trust her not to go to the police. He went ahead without her involvement, but she was far from safe. The Steinmans were taken from their home, bound with these handcuffs and leg irons, and were then put in their own van and taken to the Helzer's house. With the Steinmans in his house, Taylor produced their banking statements and told Ivan and Annette that they were going to withdraw all of their money. Dawn called Morgan Stanley, pretending to be Annette, and told the representative that she wanted to liquidate all of the Steinmans' accounts to pay for some emergency surgery for their granddaughter. Taylor then forced Annette Steinman to write out two checks to Selena for the total of $100,000. Once Taylor had what he wanted, he drugged the Steinmans with Rohypnol. Justin and Taylor stripped down to their underwear and dragged Annette into their bathroom. She was beaten to death and then dismembered. Ivan died of a heart attack when he woke up and saw what was being done to his wife of 55 years. Oh my God. Police later got surveillance footage at the bank, and you see Dawn here in a wheelchair she's using, dressed really flamboyantly. Taylor had told Dawn to wear something loud and eccentric so people would avoid talking to her. He said, "People don't like to talk to crazy people." So Dawn goes into the bank, and she explains to the teller that she was there representing the Steinmans. Well, the teller immediately knew something was up and put a hold on the checks before releasing the funds. So Dawn goes back to the Helzer home, and Taylor is furious that the deposit hasn't gone through. Taylor told Selena that he was going to give her a back rub. As Selena lay face down, Justin came into the room and hit her over the head with a hammer several times. She was then carried into the bathroom and dismembered. Dawn set about cleaning the carpet in the living room where Selena had been laying. Taylor Helzer then realizes that Selena's mother knew who he was. They had only met one time, but that meeting would end up costing Jennifer and her boyfriend James their lives. So Glenn was aware that Jennifer is house-sitting for Selena. And while Justin scrubs down the bathroom, Dawn and Taylor go to Selena's apartment. Using her key, Taylor lets himself in, goes to the bedroom, and murders the couple. He runs from the home and gets back into the car with Dawn. She drives him back to their house. This is what the 911 caller had heard, the shots and the car leaving. Then the three rent a jet ski. They took these stepping stones from their backyard and put them in the duffel bags to weigh them down. They loaded all of the bags into the back of their truck and they left, pulling the jet ski behind them. They drove to the river and were captured by a toll booth camera here as they traveled. Looking at this picture, knowing what's in the back of that truck is pretty chilling, isn't it? Justin and Taylor got on the jet ski, and Dawn drove the truck with the duffel bags in it to a secluded meeting spot. Dawn drove down to the water's edge, and the Helzers met her on the jet ski. They loaded the duffel bags onto the jet ski and took them off to dump them in the river. The three of them then went to a bar for a drink and had dinner. They drove the Steinman's van to a street away from their home and left it abandoned on the road. The police now had a full accounting of the events surrounding these brutal murders. Dawn Godman was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. I found her very easily with a quick inmate search. She is now 48 years old and sits inside the Central California Women's Facility. Justin pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, but he was found guilty and sentenced to death. In 2010, Justin tried to end his existence by jamming ballpoint pens into his eyes. He did not die. He was left blind and brain damaged. On April 14, 2013, he successfully took himself out in his jail cell. Taylor ended up pleading guilty to all charges and was sentenced to death. Glenn Taylor Helzer is now 52 years old. He is on death row at R.J. Donovan Correctional Facility. Next to his name on the prison records reads the word condemned. I found that to be a very fitting word to live side by side with this man's name, this pretend prophet, this evil and deranged monster. One of the meanings of the word condemned is officially declared as unfit for use. I guess he wasn't God's mouthpiece after all. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you enjoyed the video. And if you'd like to support me further, please subscribe to the channel and you can even join my Patreon. I'm starting to turn out some bonus content for my patrons. Stay safe, my friends, and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant, Sweet Tango Apples, guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples, too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.